Ready?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm talking to you about stuff I've done. I brought out all these files. And so this is a play that I wrote. And the name of it, I probably mentioned to you, it's called Hugo Lovell.
Oh, yeah.
And Hugo Lovell was written. That had to do with the Vietnam War and my anger at that Hugo Comfort. And so I started to write the play with the idea that Hubert Humphrey was going to be the villain of the play. And my mind did not let me do that. So I ended up that the villain of the play were the people that made the arms. And that's exactly what I did. So here's, I used as crazy names as I could. Dunca Shane. Dunca was Hubalella's sister. And Hubalella, of course, a combination of Hubert Humphrey and Cinderella. Dr. Shane and Nubda was, and its takeoff, of course, in Cinderella, the old and tyrannical King of Gomygia, and Macrofit, that was McCarthy, who was the young, handsome nephew of the king of Nubda, and then Prince Rogio was the son of Nubda from a previous marriage. Wegloop was the ugly and mean daughter of Madame Lucaria. And Lucavia is a venereal disease. And then there were two guards of the Gumligian Agency for a Tranquil Society, and then Spond and Ulix were the gnomes. And the gnomen were just like yes men, only they convinced you to ask the question so that they could always respond with no instead of yes. Because okay. They didn't want to be known. Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to change where I'm sitting because I want you to speak towards the recorder.
Okay.
All right. So.
Okay. So this was a play, and I don't know what I thought I would have. I thought it would maybe get done. And there was a man that I knew in the Democratic Party, and he had done some kind of a spoof, and I talked to him about this, but of course he wasn't interested in my play, and I've never been willing to put the time to get into getting really involved in the production of a play. So I think it's funny, but I don't think anybody with me has ever read it. The Cubella is talking about she marries the king. She's talking about a kite, and then. So, what happened here? I'm looking for something else. Then the king dies and she has to go through a process like Cinderella. Oh no, it's only she has to go through the process of being examined mentally to see if she's not only mentally, but see if she's fit to marry the present king, who would be Macbeth, who would be McCarthy. And so it was kind of take off on the Minnesota, whatever it is that they give you to see if you're...
MMPI.
MMPI, right. So let's see, what are your questions? Here, compatriot, simply write the testimony. Queen Hubalella, despite the king's erroneous judgment, evidence shows that you made no effort to alleviate, ameliorate, or expectorate, strike that last word, to ameliorate the oppression. True, false, none of the above. So then she answers that question. And let's see. What else I can tell you about the club? I had fun doing it, and I guess that's about
that's kind of how I like to look at my book right now, you know, I'm having fun doing it.
Yeah, right. So,
what is the plot, though? Can you outline it?
Well,
summarize
it's been a long
the
time
plot?
Since she's the king dies, and Then she is to marry either McCarthy, who is McCarthy, or the Rogill. Rogill. See, Cuba Lala is the queen. Or Rogill, who is the son of the king from a previous marriage. And so there's a search through the kingdom for somebody that's fit, that's going to be the queen. And she applies, and then she has to go through. And then, so, she didn't marry him. I don't remember my own point here. She says, for when she begged King he married somebody else, Macbeth did. And then one day, Ubalella was flying a very big kite. And both the queen and the kite were flown to the neighboring kingdom of Tula Libra. And there, Queen Ubalella opened an apothecary shop, discovered a cure for hammer toes, the common cold, and the cause of greed. And after that, the Tula Librians were so grateful that they crowned her king. You mean queen? That is queen once and once removed. No, I said king, and I meant king. She lived there for many years and was eventually married to a handsome Domitian prince, Charminato, the son of Macrophic and Weglu. I do like a happy ending. And so that's the end of Ubalella. So we'll, that's it.
So, but before you get out, so, but the theme of the play was...
Oh, the theme of the play was, the reason I wrote the play was to say that this is kind of a takeoff on the situation with Humphrey in when he ran for president, and he did not speak out against the war. And this is all very convoluted, but that's what made me write the play.
Sure, but I'm just trying to draw the connection that's there that most people, or some people at least, I'm sure would get right away. But so the storyline is about the marrying the queen off.
Right.
And that's Ubalella.
Right.
And Humphrey having allegiance to the president, to Johnson, and so forth? And
I didn't get into that. This is just kind of skim the surface.
Right, but I mean, in terms of the plot line, the storyline of a marriage, I'm just trying to see the allegory. You've got to have an allegory, a metaphor.
It's there.
Here
I
somewhere.
Have to read it again.
Okay.
It's been too long. It's probably been, that was when I would have written it at least in 70. So that's how many years ago?
39.
That's a long time.
It is.
That's a long time. Okay.
All right.
So that goes to that.
All right.
Now this, these I came across, and these are letters that I wrote Carmelinda years ago.
Okay.
And Carmelinda was going through a very bad time then. And so she told me, and I wrote these letters. I didn't get much. I wrote all these letters to her. This was in 1985. And she told me that she treasured those letters, that she would read them and she'd go back and read them again and again because she was so unhappy. And I had no idea. I must have had an idea. Because why would I have written? Look at them. And I wrote all these letters. And what did I write them about? Well, I wrote them about my life. I wrote them about my life.
Well, those would be good for me to.
Right. Yeah, all about my life here. Yeah. I'm going to return to the story of my mother, your great-grandmother. I'm also going to write you about your great-great-grandmother and great-great-grandfather, but that'll be in letters to come. Then I told about my mother having cancer. And then I told about... Oh, you would be interested in this. I forgot to mention that when my mother was about 37, she must have been younger than that, she came down with cancer and was ill for almost about a year. She had cancer of the bladder. And at that time, nobody had ever survived this particular kind of cancer.
I didn't remember you telling me about this. Yeah,
then I let go of that.
Yeah, I broke it. Yeah,
it was. okay. And then, let's see, I don't go for this. And then, oh, I get, here's one I told about the vegetables. Black-eyed peas, turnip greens, beets, spinach, okra, on. When I came north, I was amazed that people had such a meager selection of vegetables. Southern cooking of vegetables means that they are cooked much, much longer than it's done here in Minnesota. And then I went into the cooking of vegetables. So, anyhow, you might be able to use letters from there. Those are the letters. Incidentally, all this stuff is very, very, very valuable, so take good care of it.
Well, that's, you know, we'll have to talk about it.
Now, this, some of the letters are the funniest. I can't believe that I wrote some of these letters.
Oh, more letters to the editor?
Oh, yeah. August the 12th, 1978, Mr. Bob Rummel, the editor, the Independent. Dear Mr. Rummel, things are not always what they appear. Thus, the recent Independent articles announcing the promotion of two men and one woman in the First Northwestern Bank of Marshall would indicate that women receive equal treatment at the bank. However, the article itself treats Linda Williams unfairly by not giving the reader a resume of her qualifications, experience, and community involvement, as was done with the men. The only statements about her are that she started with the bank in May of 1969 as a teller. Her husband's name is Daryl, and they have one daughter. Is the writer of the article saying that Mrs. Williams needs to be identified as her husband's wife? If not, why did not the writer give us the names of the wives of Messrs. Hoffman and Mammon? And what about the children of the men, sexes and ages? Mrs. Williams has worked several years longer at the bank than either of the men. But you can bet your last overdraft charge that her pay comes nowhere near that of the men. It's also interesting to note that in the column next to this little gem, that two local First Northwestern employees were recently appointed members of the Minnesota Bankers Association Lending Committee for 1978-79. Any bets as to what sex they were? I don't know whether they got published. I don't know what people thought I was crazy today. And there's the article.
Oh,
oh, and this is nothing to you. Now, this is so funny because I wrote this letter to this, what's her name? Wall. What was her first name? Because I knew her.
Rosalie
Wall. And because I had a woman talk to me about this situation, and I felt it was so unjust. She could not take the Bar Association because she had a breakdown and gone through therapy, and they knew it, and therefore they would not permit her to take the bar examination. So, here's, I want you to think of it. Justice Wallace asked, oh, and then I found that when they wrote me the letter, the answer, they by mistake sent me the working papers that came along with the letter, and she had spent a lot of time answering my letter. Here's the original letter. One of the questions on the Minnesota Bar Examination asked the applicant to list all instances of mental or emotional difficulties, such as in 91, he or she has experienced and the treatment received. In addition, the applicant is asked to furnish medical records covering the illness or illnesses. I would assume the reason this question is asked is to assist the bar in determining the mental stability of the applicant. It appears to me that if a student had been able to get through law school, this in itself is evidence of mental stability. Would it not be the responsibility of law instructors and law professors and instructors to take some action if a student were obviously unfit? The question itself is one of many listed among others of a negative nature, such as arrest history and so forth. This would seem to me to be putting mental illness in an onerous position, implying that people could avoid mental illness the same as they could an arrest. It's all true, of course. I believe asking this question is unjust and especially unfair to women, for so many women in our society have experienced sexual abuse and often therapy is needed to bring them to wholeness. I believe that individuals who have gone through therapy for mental problems are often the most mentally healthy in our society. I would urge you to take whatever steps are necessary to investigate the need for this question on the bar examination. Well, she wrote me all this, and then she said they weren't going to do anything about it. So all the information is considered confidential, blah, 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 blah. But within 2 years, they took it up.
Really?
Yeah. They took it up. So, what's this one? This one's to the Knights of Columbus. I think this is going to be more fun than anything else you get. Because what did it like give about? My husband is Roman Catholic and a member of the Knights of Columbus. This is the State Council. I just finished looking it over and several things struck me. The articles contained in your publication were mainly three. Rural life, abortion, Catholic education were mainly these. Indecent literature, modern movies, and in pornography. I think the hypocrisy of the Catholic Church, not alone, of course, among churches, is what has led to our three grown children abandoning all church affiliation. Your publication certainly illustrates that. Not one article in the horrendous immoral war in Indochina, not one article on it. Tearing our country apart, alienating our young people, destroying our economic stability, increasing the ever-growing gap between the rich and the poor here and all over the world. How could you possibly put out a religious publication without at least one article about this war? How can you possibly defend your stand against abortion without taking a stand against the destruction of life that is already born? It is so totally inconsistent as to almost defy mentioning. But of course, I don't know how to do it. And blah, blah, blah. You might say that your publication is not concerned with these things, only those matters placed before your council. But if you are not, it is my opinion you should be if you believe that we should obey the commandments to love one another. So, what else would that not be? This is Margaret Benton. Oh, Andrew. That's a sweet letter from Andrew. And this is to no one who was a little more funny than some. The Attorney General. What's that about? And this is thanking me for giving a lecture to class. Impact. I think that was a student newspaper. Not that, but the black students.
Well, Impact, wasn't that at the Southwest State?
Yeah. How is it that the good people of Marshall are daily censuring the college for importing black militants? There has seldom been such a clear-cut case of self-fulfilling prophecy. The so-called militants arrive at SMSC as 18-year-old middle-class kids from their own black segregated society. Here in the rural Midwestern heartland, they're radicalized by three forces. One, education as to their own history, beauty, and treatment by white society. Two, antagonism and lack of trust on the part of the majority of white SMSC students. Three, the unkind, contemptuous treatment of blacks by the people of Marshall. The people of Marshall are truly concerned about the militancy of black students. Why don't they explore the answer scientifically? One, properly define the problem. Two, try to understand the problem. Three, try to solve the problem. And what's this one? Gasoline prices. Asked her how much publication is funded. And this isn't the response from a man named Robert Lynch. I don't know who he was. Marshall Senior High School from Stan Kroon.
Really?
Always having to do with military recruitment tests. I told him, and he said students are not excused from school for the purpose of taking these exams. Two, we are sure that from time to time, students do leave the community and attend a testing session. We do not count this as an excused absence. I don't believe in my computer. And here's one from Congress, which I probably wrote.
You ghost wrote some stuff, right?
I think I did. Oh, no, I wrote. This is about, I remember this because it irritated me so. And they still do this. This is Operation Rice Bowl that the Catholics take, send out every once a year, not every church.
I'm going to ask you to speak up a little bit.
Okay. They have these little square boxes that they sit, they give out to the parishioners to give money for world hunger at Rice Bowl.
Okay.
And so I talked to the priest and said, what kind of education do you do? Why is there such hunger in the world?
Oh.
This, all you're doing is you're giving people, which is good, but you're giving people rice, but you're not getting at the root cause of it. So why don't we have a sermon on what the root cause is? Said he would. Mike, I don't think you're not going to have some fun ever. Essays from Spain. And these, I thought I could get these published about my trip to Spain. Christmas in Catalonia. They weren't funny or anything, just in Spain. Just about my trip to Spain and how it was so lovely there. No trading stamps in Spanish groceries. And that was kind of fun because the little grocery store there was so unlike ours here. You walk in and it was just almost a little cave. And there was stuff all over the walls, but you didn't get it. You just stood there. And the one woman clerk went and picked up the stuff all over the wall. And there was a pig a week slaughtered in that little village. And that pig lived out back. But there was no smell or anything. But you could hear the pig squealing once a week when they killed the pig. This is not about water. First he said he didn't want to go, said he didn't like to be in situations he couldn't control. If not control, at least be comfortable with. And he didn't speak Spanish. One thing he didn't say was that since I do, he was afraid he would be left out of things. I announced that while I was gone, he could sit in his Coronado for companionship, which is one of the many reasons he said he couldn't go with that expensive new car. But he finally said yes when I said I was going anyhow. Once we got there, I could see him soften up from day to day. Less and less was that withdrawn look in his deep-set brown eyes, which tell you that even though he's making conversation or eating, his mind is on the eighth hole or in the briefcase looking at an affidavit. I knew that he was coming around the night we stopped at the bar for a glass of sherry. There they were playing cards, the four Spaniards. You wouldn't have thought there'd be room for a card table in that cave-like little bar on the first floor of the village house. Once animals were probably kept there, but now it's painted dark green with a dark polished counter and a shiny stainless steel machine that produces cafe con leche, hot coffee that's half milk. One of the men was a real good-looking young fellow with long curly hair smoking a long skinny cigar. One was an older man dressed better than the rest in light gray wool slacks wearing glasses same kind of frame as mine, silver with a little silver bar over the nose. One was an old man in a beret with a dark scarf around his neck, tucked into his shirt front, and the fourth was a young kid about 18. Let's see you top that, said the good-looking young fellow as he slapped a card on the table, almost overturning the whole thing as one leg gave way. Lucky, that's what you are lucky, said the man in the silver-framed glasses as he straightened the table leg. Laughing, talking loud, asking for refills of their drinks, they played, hardly noticing us. But my companion kept edging closer and closer to, can't you see Walter there, to the table, finally openly kibitzing through one hand as I talked to Amelia Martinez, who owns the bar. I had a second glass of sherry. Come here a minute, he called over to me. There aren't any queens in the deck. I walked around each spinning chair, checking the four hands for queens. Sure enough, no. I've heard Spain is a pretty macho country, I said to the men, as the young kid was dealing, but I didn't think it was so bad they wouldn't even tolerate paper queens. The men laughed and asked if we were French or German, and we said, Americans, and they said to my companion, sit down, American, and we'll show you how the Spanish play cards. Thus proving it wasn't accidental there weren't any queens in the deck by not inviting me. At first, I wasn't going to translate their remarks to him, but I finally did when he threatened to withhold my share of the traveler's check I had coming the next day. And he sat there and watched and learned how to play the game before we left. By that time, Amelia and I were on first-name basis. Just imagine. And he can't even speak the language, like I said. I can't believe it, he said on the way home. Just like poker or Buck Euchre at the country club or the Legion Hall. And the next day he looked even less withdrawn than usual and added maravilloso to his vocabulary of buenos dias and buenas noches. He was sitting apart of each day and the sun in his face was getting tan and he was looking ten instead of five years younger than his age, a vigorous 58. He hadn't looked that good since our Colorado vacation 2 years previously. Funny thing, Colorado was the name of the bar we stopped in on New Year's Day for Cafe con Leche. He was feeling a little down, big football day in the United States, and here was in a little fishing town on the Mediterranean and the sun shining and the temperature almost 70 degrees. Sitting up behind the bar at the Colorado, on a high shelf was a television set, and it was not only on, but on in living color. I was hoping he wouldn't see it and think of the Rose Bowl and all. But no way could he miss it. There were all these men and a few women sitting on high stools, cheering and shouting ole every once in a while. What's that? He asked with a start. He'd been looking out the window from the booth at the first American car he'd seen in days and was carrying on a conversation with me about whether it was a 1973 or 74 model Buick, knowing full well I couldn't tell the difference between a 1966 Chevrolet and a 1974 Toronado. A bullfight, I think, I said. That man with those sharp, pointed sticks decorated with pink and purple crepe paper is going to stick them in the bull. What's he going to do that for, he asked. To make the bull matter so it'll get more fierce, I said. Seems rather stupid, he said, but fixed his eye on the television. The bull was snorting and running after assorted figures on the screen. I went to the restroom where I could still hear an occasional bueno or ole. I stayed there quite a while talking to a French girl who's been an exchange student, in Keokuk, Iowa, where I have relatives. I just started telling him about this girl who I'd met, who'd met my Aunt Florence twice in Keokuk, and he said, shh, and then I noticed. He had that same glazed, weakened expression he gets when they're on, that is, the Vikings or the North Stars, or Johnny Miller, or the Twins, or the Gophers. After the second set of sticks had been stuck in the bull, the announcer, who'd been giving a running commentary, kind of like Howard Cosell, run backwards, said, and now let's have another look at Moncho Sanchez, the banderillero, the stick putter in her. We saw again just what we'd seen before. Instant replay, he shouted as he partially stood up in the loop. They have instant replay. Who'd have thought it? Fantastic. The matador was on in glittery coal knickers and a jacket so bright with reflected sun I could have used my dark glasses. Just look at that footwork, he said as the matador was doing this little dance step. Amazing, he went on. I bet he trains as much as a boxer. You want to hear it?
Sure, you can eat some more today.
Okay, now finish. Don't eat so much. I just having such a wonderful order. The matador now had the red muleta over his arm, hiding the sword that ends it all. He was teasing the bull, holding the muleta, two stepping aside as the bull charged, twirling the muleta, exhausting the bull, who by this time had six sharp-pointed sticks in his back with dark red stains on the crepe paper decorations. Then the matador just stops and stands there, his head bent just a little bit, looking at the bull, which is maybe 50 feet away. Stands there like a diver competing for the Olympics, he said. Just look at those feet placed so firm together, and how he goes up just slightly on the balls of his feet. Wow. There was a blare of music like the circus when the trapeze artists are getting ready to fly around at the top of the tent. A big blare with several seconds of drum rolls, like when there's no net underneath, and the matador takes out his sword and, running toward the bull, plunges it into him over his head. And the bull, who's pretty much feeble and weak, runs around and finally drops dead. Of course, they don't show the bull dying. There was just this quick shot of a couple of big work horses dragging something off the field, and I knew it was the bull. He didn't see it through. Right then, the announcer said, "Let's roll that back and take a slow look at the action." Then the matador starts his run for the bull, only this time it's a ballet dance, and in waltz time, slow waltz time, and you can see his muscle flexing. And the bull just kind of collapses on his front legs real slow. And one of the wheels came off, and when you pulled it, the buffalo would fall frontward slowly. Instant replay, and in slow motion, he said, with the appreciation he wears when he's eating a double chocolate marshmallow banana split. We decided to leave then, even though there was going to be another bull and another fighter, and the band is playing these great paso dobles, two steps. It was getting dark, and he wasn't too accustomed to international road signs. Then he walked up to the counter, tucking his shirt in a little bit like he does when he's not wearing a suit coat. He said something to the bartender, funny. "The bartender speaks English," he said when we were leaving. He was telling me this bullfighter works out just like Muhammad Ali. Today, if you ask him about the trip, he'll say, "Great country, Spain. Those people are just like Americans." Okay, I'm not sure. And this is a story. I made this story up. Okay. I don't have the picture. I should have the picture. No. I made the story up because... Oh, it's in here. You can see it. It's the most moving picture I've ever seen. Mm. It's of a little, of a baby.
Right.
And you heard me talk about it. And the vulture's waiting. And this is the story I wrote about it. And they gave me some sort of an award over at St. Catherine's for, I don't know what, something. And so it's ordinary that you give a speech or something, talk about something important to you. And so I decided that instead of a speech, I would read the short story that I read, which I really wrote for the occasion. And then I decided that I should try to get, because this was such, maybe I've told you this story, but because it was such a moving photograph, you knew that vulture was going to eat that baby, that I thought I should get a copy of that and have it shown on a big overhead when I read the story. So I wrote the newspaper, and I found out that this picture was one of the most famous pictures, news pictures ever, and that the man that had taken them had died, and that the money from the sale of these pictures went to his, no, had been bought, the rights had been sold to somebody else. So I had to call the people who owned the picture
Oh, to get permission.
To get permission. And I asked them if we could show it, if we could have it. And the person, who was a man, said, well, the third person said that it was, I think I made two calls. It was something like $500. And so I called again, I think they said I could help somebody else. And the second person I talked to, I said, well, you know, I said, I'm going to give this talk to the nuns at the Commandolate Center, the nuns at Sisters of St. Joseph. And I said, they don't have any money. We can't afford to pay. Oh, he said, you mean the Sisters of Randolph Avenue? And I said, yeah, you know, yeah. He said, I'm St. Paul. And so he said, oh, well, we'll make you a special price. I think they let me have it for $25. And so it was up showing as I read the story. And before me, there were two awards given, and one was given to a faculty member. And she came out, and I don't think she prepared anything. She gave this little talk. I bet she had, it was almost spur of the moment. But I really, that just showed it was no big deal to her, the right. fact that she was given this award. But I think it's a pretty good story. You've never read it.
I'm sure not.
Well, I would like you to read it.
Okay.
It's called Bush Baby, and I named it that because there was a baby in the bush.
Sure.
But there is something, I think there's a little animal or an insect or something called Bush Baby.
Okay.
So it ended up with them. And nobody ever wanted to print it. Never got printed, of course.
Did you go through the other things here?
I think they're all, I think that track was, I think.
It was all about the Bush Baby.
Yeah, I think that, those,
oh, yeah.
I think.
Copies.
Copies,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's what was, when it was published in the newspaper.
Oh, there is the copy that I want to show you. Yeah. I had that up over my desk for ages in St. Paul because it made me so mad that because that little baby is black, you know, that wouldn't be tolerated. We wouldn't, white people wouldn't tolerate that in a white country. And black people don't have the power. So anyhow, and this is Rob Sanders, that wasn't much, that was a tidbit, Bennett. And what is this? Lisa Pinsky, what's that all about? I don't know. Thank you for your friendship. I don't know what that was all about, but it was a lovely letter, and I saved it. Okay, I think I did that. I need to do something, but I don't. I think you want to say these in particular. I gave a class in a talking to political science class right there. And then this is
all confusion.
Yeah, let's see. We got water. And this is
how big is your commitment?
Yeah. That's it.
Okay.
I think forgotten that we had, I had three signatures. This was in 1995, or 96, I guess. We went to the St. Patrick's Day Parade, and they had a tank. Well, no, military helicopter. That was a tank. And I thought, why would they have a military helicopter in a St. Patrick's Day Parade? What is it doing? That's a religious parade, St. Patrick was. So I wrote, and then Bridget McDonald signed it, and Jim Steinhagen signed it, Veterans for Peace. He questioned it. With the continued violence in Ireland, we would question the emphasis that such interest gives to the use of force to settle conduct. Would you let us hear from you? We never heard of it, but that was the last time they ever had anything. They never had any more military stuff in the parade. So it could have just been just one of those crazy things. You can't say it did it. So, let's see. I was invited to a reception of the Distinguished Women's Advisory Conference. This was to the president of the St. Catharines College, Women as Agents of Social Change. And in there was Jerry Joseph. The name was Jerry Joseph.
And this is Jerry Joseph.
Well, she was. The Democratic National Chairwoman, I think. She was a great friend of Hubert Humphrey's. And her husband had been the minister of. And I knew her from Democratic politics. I've known Mrs. Joseph for many years, and I would make no objections to St. Catherine's recognition of her personally. However, Mrs. Joseph cannot be left off the hook. Get off the hook for her responsibility for the deaths of many innocent people in the world. As for many years, she was a member of the board of directors of the Honeywell Corporation, a leading manufacturer of weapons, including landmines, which are today responsible for the deaths of 500 non-combatants each week. Several years ago, Honeywell sold off the portion of its company that manufactures weapons to Alliant Tech. But Honeywell accepts no responsibility whatsoever for the removal of those bombs. Mrs. Joseph was fully aware of the corporation's product when she was on the board, but defended it. I'm enclosing a recent copy of an article from the Catholic Reporter discussing these landmines. As I looked over the list of other women in the panel dealing with social justice, I wonder how many of them are employed by companies which are also agents of death, as was Honeywell. What about Quick Response Services, TTX Company, and APC Advisory? You do not need to respond to this letter. I have no idea how I would respond to it were I in your place. It is not an easy question.
So you didn't go?
No, I don't
know where
I went. I don't know where I went. I don't even know. Oh, and this was, I think, when Marianne and I were given an award at a group here. Oh, and here's a letter from Peter Frank. I want that. That he sent me in 1994.
So at some point we should discuss, you know, now that you've gone through some of it, if you can remember why you do all this or what.
Well, maybe
what makes
I'm
you
thinking.
Think.
Well, as you can see, there is reward in it. But that isn't why you do it. I mean, I don't do it for this, because if I did, I would kind of sit and say to myself, well, am I going to get recognized or something? And it always comes as a surprise. I do it because something in me just makes me do it. Just, don't you have that same feeling, don't you?
Well, we'll keep this tape running about you and not
right.
me. When we turn the tape off, we can talk about me.
Oh, this is just a little, this is just a funny little essay about buying a skirt, which I didn't buy, that I really wanted to, I should have, but I thought I should have, I didn't need it, and so I argued with myself about it. Oh, and this is about the birth of one of you. I don't think it was. It was in Wyndham. And this was an argument I had with the nurse. She was so mean.
Oh, I think I remember you telling me about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Box, and I
gave her a box of chocolate.
Just for to be mean.
This was like a short story based on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were on the MCLU, I see the back of this is MCLU stuff. You were on the MCLU for
I think Walker told me this, a story, and I wrote it about he and somebody else having to confine an old man, having to pick him up and put him, having to go to the nursing home.
Hmm.
It was so sad, and I don't think I would have else would I've known about it, but it's just a sad story, committing him. And this, I probably never told you about this. This is a children's story. It's a children's play, and it's called The Masked Emperor. I never told you about it.
I don't think so.
Well, it's about, it's just a short little play.
I mean, you've got enough plays and short stories here. Your person can, I mean, that, you know, you could just bound those all up in a...
I know, but nobody would, if I couldn't sell them when I'm trying to sell them, why would anybody read them?
Yeah.
See, I just, I don't think they have it. This was about, The Masked Emperor was about a woman who's an empress, actually, but I call her an emperor, who is talking to her daughter, and her daughter is thinking, as she looks at her mother, I'm going to be the queen someday. I wonder what it's going to be like when my mother's dead. And the queen at that moment realized that she could read her daughter's mind. And then she could read other people's thoughts. And she found it so disturbing that she didn't know what to do about it. And then she found out one day when she was wearing a mask or something that if she couldn't see them, she couldn't read their mind. And so then she became masked herself always so that she couldn't do it, so that she could stand to live and not know what to do. And I don't think, well, you can get to it.
Well, that, I mean, there's a number of TV shows right now with that exact.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Well, that was, I didn't see any TV show like that. Now, and this is a play I don't think I've ever told you about, Zenger. This little condensation just tells about. I just read about him, and it just kind of interested me. The play based on an actual historical event involving John Peter Zenger takes place in 1792, when the U.S. was still part of the British Empire. Zenger was a German immigrant printer who established the first partisan political journal in the U.S., the New York Weekly Journal, in which he accused of corruption the governor of New York, an appointee of the king. Zenger was tried for printing libelous material. The verdict set the precedent for an important principle of law still in effect today, and that precedent is you cannot be found guilty of libel if it's true. In other words, the truth is never libelous. The names of characters are actual names, and much of the material comes from the transcripts.
But didn't you just do that recently? Wasn't that, you did something very similar to that just recently. You were asked me, you talked about me being in part of reading one of the parts. Remember?
Well, where were we going to do it?
No, you did it around the summer, or somebody else did it.
Maybe so.
About libel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Now, these, I didn't go for the view that was last, because that's too much. And somewhere I've got a box of all my political stuff.
Well, I've got a lot. You've given me a lot.
Have you got? Have you got all my campaign literature?
No.
Well, that's what I've got, too. I've got a whole box full of my campaign itself.
Wow. Which would contain a lot more of your right. Thoughts and
excerpts from letters of Michael Mann.
Hmm.
Age 6, November the 3rd, 1961, to his aunt Marcella. And then age 27, Christmas 1982, to his father Walter.
Hmm.
And then written by Michael Mann, a student at Marshall High School, 1972, Second Guessing Alice. That was that essay he wrote in Alice in Wonderland. So that's here. And then, yeah. Then here's Carmel Linda. I've got stuff, a word from Walter.
this was a book review of Alice in Wonderland.
Yes. Here's a letter from Walter to his to Marcello, and then then his instructions to the jury that they refused to let him use when he came up here. Mm-hmm. You remember that. And then the Barbara, this is stuff from her. And this is again from more stuff from me, my biography.
This guy?
Yeah, this is more my stuff, biography stuff. This is our house. That's funny.
In Wyndham or?
No, in Hot Springs, where I grew
up. Oh, okay.
Robert, Andrew, and Clydetta are dead, but I don't know who I wrote that for, because those are my grandparents. Oh, I wrote it. This is the house speaking.
Oh. Oh, interesting.
The city lot that was and is my home is quite deep.
You've written a lot of different things.
I wrote this, yeah. Looking at 627 from the outside, you notice on the north the alley which goes through to Market Street next to the alley, the long cement floored portico which ran the length of the house and served as an open door garage. I didn't finish carry through since I didn't finish this as writing this is me. Oh, I wish I'd been able to take notes over the years about what went on under my nose, so to speak, between the colored help and the Simpson family. They have provided fascinating story material. Verna, Idella, Vera, and Nettie, those were the women that I can remember, plus how many others I can. Mrs. Simpson prided herself on being fair with each maid and washerwoman. That is, she paid them the going rate, $5 a week, as I remember, for the maids, who worked every day except Sunday afternoon and one other afternoon. The washerwoman, who worked two long days a week, received $2.50. The relationship between family members and the colored help was a curious one. The help was as familiar with each member of the family as a pair of worn carpet slippers. And the family was aware of the general situation of the health, but their interior knowledge of ideas of the health was never expressed. There was goodwill and occasionally jokes. Nettie, for example, claimed that the family pet, a black cat, was their brother. That was true from another life. This was after Dr. Simpson's death, of course. He would never have tolerated any animal in the house. Carry diseases, that's what he said they did. He had a bunch of idiosyncrasies, like not letting any of the family swallow watermelon. They were permitted to chew it up, but they had to spit out the pulp. Downright disgusting it was to watch them eat watermelon. But the black and white relationships could never have been characterized as friendships, and then so forth. So that's that. That's that. And this. Oh, I never told you about this. It was a study of a thesis that a woman that I knew did. And
now, is this the one that did the movie?
No.
No, somebody else.
Yeah. And how would you describe PX's leadership style? This is all about me. Bold, assertive, anticipated needs.
Yeah, was she a sociology student or?
I don't know. Colloquium on Contemporary Theories of Leadership.
Oh, this is very recent, well, 2001.
Yeah.
Huh. So instead of using WAM, she used WOW.
Well, I don't know why, but there must have been some.
WOW and change.
Yeah, her. Yeah. This is a little. This is not much. Now let's see what this is. Miscellaneous correspondence. I have no. I didn't even open this. This one here. So I don't
know. This could be the favorite girl. These are all letters to you, apparently.
No, I don't. This is a copy of the letter I wrote him.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, this is about Barbara, in which I wrote Irvin about what happened to her in Pennsylvania when she got threatened at that train station.
What was that? I remember that vaguely.
Well, it's here. She was manager of the Philadelphia office of Eugene McCarthy's campaign. She was living at Newtown, Pennsylvania, with her husband Peter. She spent a few weeks in Washington organizing. During this period, her telephone at Newtown was tapped. She and her husband were followed by men driving white Cadillac cars. From what she and her friend suspected, their conversation was being tapped. As they drove along in a car, by a pound truck just ahead of them, and another car following close behind.